aluminum steps and moved through the crowd to stand at the curb. A breathtaking tall woman with an interesting scythe-like scar saw us and approached, swinging her dark hair back. "Coaches and contestants only, beyond this point." Henry smiled. "How do you know I am not a coach?" Chief Long didn't smile. "Because no one in their right mind would let you be responsible for youth." "She's got a point." Long stopped, and I found it amusing that she and her niece stood in exactly the same posture. "Hi, Walt."
"Hi, Lolo."
"Nice scar." I gestured toward the young woman now shooting foul shots with the assistance of one of her teammates. "Another athlete in the family?"
"Extended family. She was having trouble at home, so I allowed her to stay in my basement, but only if she lived by the rules."
"How's she doing?" She turned to look at the young player.
"Pretty well.
She's got her senior year to go, but there's already interest from the UConn, Duke, Stanford."
"So she's smart, too?"
The Northern Cheyenne Tribal Police Chief growled, "Too smart for her own good." I glanced at Henry and then back to the chief. "So there's a problem?"
"She's a teenager, so there are nothing but problems. You had one of those, didn't you?"
"I thought of my daughter and granddaughter down in Cheyenne."
"I did.
And another one to go someday."
"There's the stuff you normally have to contend with, but this is a little different."
She sighed, running a hand through her hair.
"Threats."
"What kind of threats?"
"Life-threatening threats."
Henry inclined his head and lip pointed. "Show him the note, Lolo." She reached into a pocket inside her jacket and produced a copy of a note that had been on the kind of paper you'd find in a school binder. She handed it to me and folded her arms. I studied the typewritten words, which were pretty horrific, describing actions and making threats on par with the worst I'd ever seen.
"Where was this given to her?"
"Here in Billings."
"At an event or game?"
"No, when she and her friends came up to see a movie. It was left under the windshield wiper of her car."
I flipped it over, looking for something that might resemble a clue.
"Another student? I mean, it is notepaper from something like a binder."
Long shook her head. "I don't think that's the language or idiom of a high school student. Do you?"
"Not really."
"But I'm assuming you talked to her friends."
"I have."
"And?"
"Nothing." She took the paper back.
"You don't think this has a racist slant?"
"It does."
"Ever heard of the Brotherhood of the North?"
"No."
She refolded the note and pocketed it.
"It's a white supremacist hate group here in Montana. You might want to check them out."
"You think they're responsible for the threats?"
"It fits their M.O.
"How many contacts has she received?"
23.
I sighed.
"Since?"
"It all started with a feature article they did in the Billings Gazette, which got picked up in the AP Wire, along with some TV and radio interviews."
"You contacted the local authorities?"
She cocked her head, the dark hair covering one eye.
"I am the local authorities."
"Sounds like you need a bodyguard for her."
She glanced over her shoulder at insouciance personified with a basketball, still shooting foul shots.
"Among other things."
I gestured toward the bear.
"You've got the best in the world right here."
She studied me.
"I need an investigator."
"You are an investigator."
"I need a white investigator.
Nobody is taking this seriously. But if I get you on board, then people might start paying attention. Besides, as much as I hate admitting it, you're the best."
"Well, as much as I'd like to help, I don't say..."
"She's like a daughter to me, Walt. I don't think I could stand it if something happened to her."
"It's not even my state.
Things wouldn't heat up until late fall. Early winter, months away."
"I don't know.
Just meet her." She turned and yelled, "Jaya!"
The young woman didn't respond and kept shooting, even though it was pretty obvious that she'd heard her aunt.
"Jaya Long!"
I watched as she finally turned, at the stiffness in her neck and the pride of her strut as she approached. And all I could think of was a kid I'd known years ago, a kid with too much muscle and not enough brains headed off to play offensive line for the University of Southern California. A crew-cut kid in a hand-me-down pickup truck who had never seen the ocean. A kid who thought he had the world by the tail and would soon come to figure out that
That world's tale was something you'd do well to never, ever grab. Jaya got close, and I could see she was about 6 feet tall, a smidge taller than her aunt, and that she made sure the older woman knew it.
Yeah?
Giving her a good humping of silence, Lolo gestured toward us. This is Henry Standing Bear and Sheriff Longmire. There was a flicker of recognition as she glanced at the bear, who had played in a Montana high school state championship himself back in the day and was a legend across the High Plains courts. Then she looked my way and immediately flicked me into the aged dustbin the way only a young woman's eyes can. I extended a hand. Walt Longmire, nice to meet you. She ignored the hand and didn't make eye contact.
Sheriff, huh?
Yep. Lolo crowded in, her face inches from her niece's. You greet this man properly with the respect he deserves. He's meeting you as an act of consideration, and you do not ignore another person's consideration. The teen backed away a half step, gesturing toward the court. I've got a game. If you don't behave properly, this game and any others will be put on ice until you can learn to control yourself. She dropped her head with an exasperated sigh, and when her face came up with a dazzling grin, the transformation was pretty impressive. She extended her hand. Jaya Long, so pleased to meet you. I shook the hand. Nice to meet you, too. The smile slammed shut like a door as she turned to her aunt. Can I go now? Lolo stared at her for a moment and then gave a curt nod, and we watched as Jaya loped off to join her teammates. I glanced at Lolo and leaned over to her ear. Are you sure you're not the one who wrote those notes? Chapter 8. Bits of ribbon fluttered from the budding branches of a stunted juniper, the National Forest Service having decided to allow the dancing prayer flags to have their day and every other since 1876. We don't know, we just come by here and there's another one tied to the branches. Hundreds of them, actually. She leaned out the window of one of those elaborate golf carts the park rangers use to patrol the battlefield. The Indians aren't as bad as the tourists. There was a man who wanted to know why we didn't plant grass and water the hill, since it was a gravesite after all. I guess they missed the point. The older woman poked her smoky bear hat back on her silver locks. Sand, rocks, and sagebrush. That's the way it was when they died. And it's the way it should stay, I swear. If they had their druthers, there'd be beer and hot dog stands and souvenir shops right here on the hill. The history books say that there were no survivors of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. But there were thousands, thousands who waited after the battle for the other cavalry boot to drop. The combined nations of the Lakota and the Cheyenne, and even the five Arapaho who had fought, knew that a retribution was coming. They just didn't know when. Vic slipped her thumbs into the back pockets of her jeans and looked down the ridge that had carried the seventh to their doom.
I can't believe I've lived here all these years and never been here. I mean, I saw it from the highway, but here it's different.
I waved goodbye to the ranger and regarded the prayer tree one last time before stepping up with my friends. In what way?
Fucking haunted.
It was a difficult statement to argue with, standing there above the winding river with the trees that had witnessed the battle and the mountains, our mountains, strung along the horizon, scraping the afternoon sky raw. Private Charles Windolph. Vic looked back at me. He one of those markers down there? Nope, but he said that what he saw here would haunt him to his grave. Men staggering around in circles, confused and bleeding, wandering through the broken skirmish line at the ridge that looked down at the bloodstained grass, and the waves of heat that distorted the vision of the dying men who lay there screaming for water, while others farther down the slope were being hacked to bits by Lakota and Cheyenne warriors.
This Windolph guy, he was here?
Yep. He had arrived in New York 6 years previously, had left Germany to avoid getting conscripted in the Franco-Prussian War, but he couldn't get a job, mostly because he couldn't speak English. And so he figured a great way to learn the language might be to join the army. Faulty logic. He was with Colonel Banteen, Company H, up here farther down the ridge, and he got a Medal of Honor for providing cover fire for the men who were attempting to get water. Vic kneeled and plucked a piece of grass from the hillside and placed the stem into her mouth.
He survived?
till 1950, buried over in the Black Hills. I thought there weren't any survivors. The Cheyenne Nation shook his head, turned, and walked past us.
None of Custer's personal command survived.
We watched as he continued to cross the roadway, dodging the tourist buses, and quietly unaware of the looks he was receiving from the many tourists, who were probably sure they were seeing the living embodiment of Crazy Horse or a distant relative of Sitting Bull.
He gets emotional up here.
She smiled a sad smile. I can understand that. His people may have won the battle, but in the end they lost the war. Nomadic tribes with nowhere to be nomads. We eventually followed Henry and entered a walkway on the other side, where a large mound of earth rose up with the memorial to Wooden Leg and the Unknown Warrior, with red dirt at its center and wall panels for each of the tribes that fought there, and above them the outlines of the spirit warriors who stretched horizontally, ghostly figures. The bear stood there, looking through them at the high plains sky, taut and threadbare blue. A few people walked around the place, giving him room.
Many Cheyenne children were born on the trail north from our imprisonment in Oklahoma. Women would fall back in the hollows or clumps of sage to give birth to children whose mouths and noses were held shut to keep them from crying as the long knives.
Cavalry, I interpreted. The bear nodded and continued.
Would ride past. Then the women, carrying their children, would sneak through them in the night to rejoin the tribe. These children would learn the most important Cheyenne virtue first. Silence.
He smiled back at us.
There is a saying among my people that none are truly defeated until the hearts of their women are on the ground.
Vic attempted to get the chronology straight. This is before the battle?
Yes. There were many things that led to this travesty, including the Battle of Washita River, where Custer took his Cheyenne wife.
She turned to look at him. You mentioned that back at the bar.
Mona Sita, the 15-year-old daughter of Little Rock. After the battle in Oklahoma, some 53 women and children were used as human shields and then taken captive by the 7th Cavalry. By all accounts, the young woman was beautiful, and Custer took her as his own. According to Benteen, Chief of Scouts Ben Clark, and the histories of my people, she bore him a son.
Holy crap!
There's some conjecture about that.
They both looked at me. Custer contracted syphilis while at West Point, which evidently left him sterile, leading some to believe that it was his brother Thomas who impregnated the girl.
These guys were real charmers, huh?
Henry shrugged.
A Custer is a Custer.
She stared up at the sculpture and the skeletal figures on horseback. You think they knew who was attacking them? The bear shook his head.
No, I think not. They simply knew that they were being attacked, and that they needed to protect the women, children, and the aged.
They didn't know that they'd killed Custer?
Eventually.
He glanced at me and turned to look at her.
Do you know what the winter count is?
No.
It is a pictorial account of a tribe's achievements painted on an animal hide, a sort of annual calendar of events of any great importance to the Cheyenne.
So?
The Battle of the Greasy Grass appears in none of them. For my people, it was a skirmish, and a disorderly one at that.
Watching his eyes, I saw them travel past Vic and me. Turning, we found about 120 people standing behind us, with their sunglasses and ball caps, the tour buses having just disgorged their contents. Everyone was silent, held in thrall as they recorded the bear on their cell phones, held aloft. The Cheyenne Nation nodded solemnly and raised his hands.
The next show is at 2 o'clock.
Under the watchful eyes of Cassidy Adams's print of Custer's last fight, we ate our big Crow Indian tacos, sipped iced tea, and looked out from under the eaves of the outdoor dining room at the teepees along the edge of the Custer Battlefield Trading Post parking lot. So when does the guest of honor arrive? The bear smiled.
Who knows? He is a chief and works on Indian time.
Has he always been that way?
Yes, it is so.
We both smiled into our empty plates as Vic continued eating like a civilized person.
So what are we going to do about your stolen painting?
It wasn't really a painting, and it wasn't really mine. Taking another bite, she chewed on that and swallowed.
What was it worth?
Not much, according to the experts. She turned to Henry, who had already finished his mammoth lunch.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
Buy a heater for my bar that worked.
And a sump pump for the basement during irrigation season. He sipped his iced tea.
I could afford both.
I think so.
She gestured toward me. My lame-brained boss just gave away a cool million. The bear shrugged.
It is his nature.
Vic made a face. What's that?
Honesty.
She turned back to me.
I want a new truck.
Go buy one.
I don't have any money.
The county does.
She slumped back in her chair.
They do?
The department hasn't bought a vehicle in more than 12 years, so we're probably due.
You're kidding.
Nope.
She sat forward, studying me.
Don't you want a new truck?
No.
She thought about it.
How come you don't ever tell me these things?
You never asked.
It's like the computer I got. You just put in a requisition and the county commissioners say yay or nay.
Henry leaned in and stuck a hand out to stall the conversation.
Wait. You have a computer?
I nodded and gestured toward my second in command.
Yep, but they made me give it back.
He turned to Vic, who shrugged.
Wasn't me. Ruby decided it was more trouble teaching him how to use it than it was just doing the shit herself.
Hey, Bebe Esiva.
The chief of the Cheyenne Nation and tribal elder, Lonnie Littlebird, was rolled forward to our table. A muscular young man who looked familiar, steering him over and smiling down at us as the chief displayed a mock anger.
You have eaten without me?
Glancing up at the young man, he shook his fist.
Gone are the days when the younger generation paid tribute and treated their elders with respect they richly deserved. Yes, it is so.
Barrett Long, Police Chief Lolo Long's little brother, extended a hand to Vic, then to Henry, and finally to me, before glancing back at Lonnie.
You want a Coke, old man?
The indignity disappeared.
Yes, with ice, please.
He turned back to us once the young man was safely out of ear reach.
He is a very good boy.
The bear placed a hand on the old Indian's arm, slender with pronounced veins.
How are you, Lonnie?
My legs hurt.
You do not have any legs.
That is probably why they hurt.
He glanced at Vic.
Aye.
She smiled.
Aye. Have we met?
Yes. He leaned in toward her.
Did we sleep together?
I don't think so.
Well, hopefully we will get another chance. Yes, it is so.
He turned back to me.
Someone has stolen your painting?
I gave out with my rote response. It wasn't really a painting, and it wasn't really mine. Ignoring me, he threw the lock on his wheelchair and leaned back like a self-satisfied potentate.
When was the last time we worked on a case together?
I glanced at Henry and cleared my throat. I don't think we've ever worked on a case together, Lonnie.
The time we caught that guy who robbed the Blue Cow Cafe, and then the other one a year and a half ago.
He reached out and patted my hand.
That was a good case, the one with the girl who fell. We broke that one wide open, didn't we?
I glanced at Henry, who shrugged.
Yep, we did.
You should be looking for a white person. They steal things.
He glanced around.
They stole a whole country from us.
Attempting to distract him, Henry inquired as to the subject of late.
They were asking about the Battle of the Greasy Grass, Lonnie.
Lost in thought for a moment, he pursed his lips and began speaking.
My grandfather fought in this battle, but he never talked about it. He never talked about anything. There was a time when I was growing up that I thought he didn't know how to talk. One time when we were sitting under a tree reading, he farted and closed his book and said, "Excuse me." And I remember looking around and thinking the tree had spoken.
Barrett arrived with the Coke and sat it in front of Lonnie.
"No straw?"
"You said ice. You didn't say anything about a straw, old man."
"Get me a straw before I run over your big feet with my chair."
Watching him go, he turned back to us.
"He is a very good boy."
Puzzled, he stared at the soda.
"Where was I?"
The bear quietly urged.
"Your grandfather."
"What about him?"
"The Battle of the Greasy Grass."
"My grandfather, he was there."
Henry nodded patiently.
"Tell us some more."
Lonnie gave out with a tiny gasp, struck with recommencing his story.
"I was going through his dresser drawer one time looking for his pocket knife, something that I wasn't supposed to be doing, and I found something strange in with his socks, a totem or charm. It was shaped like a bird, but with this funny tuft of hair on top of its head."
Barrett arrived with a straw and unwrapped it, placing it in the chief's glass and pulling up the chair he'd moved for Lonnie.
"You still telling that same story, maeso?"
Seeing Vic make a face, the young man explained. "He had another guy who rolled him around and said, 'Yes, sir,' and 'No, sir,' but he got bored and fired him." He whispered, "You might think I'm being disrespectful, but it's just job security." Lonnie waved a hand at him. "Hush up and learn something." He turned back to us.
"So I found this tiny stuffed bird made of deerskin and took it out in the yard and was playing with it when he came over and snatched it away from me."
Lonnie thought back.
"He was very angry, and I'd never seen him that way. He held the totem up to me and said that this was the true little bird in battle, and that he had worn it since his first combat experience when he was 13 years old. That he would tie the charm to himself and that it gave him protective powers so long as the charm was never hit."
Vic smiled, never one to be taken in by spirituality. "And he tried this out, did he?" Lonnie nodded.
"The second time at the Battle of the Greasy Grass, he was maybe 17 years of age and said that he was old enough to notice a great many things and see the reasons for them. He said the Cheyenne had been on the camp by the Little Bighorn for only one night. He said the next day around noon, the troopers charged down Reno Creek and drove all the people out of the northern camp and set fire to the lodges. But the people from the lower camp heard the noise and rushed north. The troopers retreated as the people surrounded them. My grandfather said the soldiers seemed drunk, but I think he meant panic-stricken and that they couldn't shoot straight."
The bear rested a chin in his palm.
"This would be Reno's detachment."
Lonnie nodded.
"Mm-hmm. Yes, it is so."
"Perhaps they were drunk."
Lonnie shrugged.
"Perhaps. If I had been there, surrounded by that many hostiles, I would have wished to be Stinko too."
His eyes went past me to the hill on the other side of the road where the battle had actually taken place.
"The soldiers could have stayed in the cover of the trees, but instead crossed the river and rode to the high bluff where my grandfather said they were left alone because the men wished to return to the village to check on their loved ones. As they returned, they heard more noise and realized it was another assault. My grandfather said there was a woman who grabbed at his foot and told him that the soldiers were attacking from the north, so my grandfather turned and rode toward them. He said that the long hair and his men were at the level space at the bottom of the dry creek, and that the men on both sides fought valiantly, and that a man tried to shoot him from his pony when he charged him, but the soldier's carbine misfired, and so he knocked the man down with the butt of his pistol. When he turned his horse, the cavalryman was getting up and clearing his weapon and reloading. Raising the gun toward my grandfather, he fired."
Lonnie lifted the straw to his mouth as we all waited. Tasting the soda, he made a face and looked at Barrett.
"Did you get me a Diet Coke?"
"I got you a Coke, old man." Lonnie made a face, licking his lips.
"This tastes like Diet Coke."
Barrett made an agonizing cry in the back of his throat.
Finish
your story. What story? The story you're going to tell before I strangle you to death. He nudged the glass toward the young man with his fingertips.
Go get me a real Coke.
Barrett folded his tan arms. Finish the story before I roll you into traffic. Lonnie turned back to us, leaning in confidentially.
Have I spoken of the lack of respect that these young ones have for their elders these days?
The Cheyenne Nation blew his breath out from pursed lips.
You have mentioned it, yes.
Lonnie glanced around.
Where was I?
The cavalryman at the Battle of the Greasy Grass who shot your grandfather, I ventured.
Which time?
The second, I think. Placing his hands on the table, he reared back.
Misfire! The soldier's rifle misfired again, and my grandfather shot him in the chest.
He touched the spot at his sternum.
Here!
The hand dropped to his lap.
My grandfather used to say that there were many kinds of men before a battle, but only two kinds after, the living and the dead.
He turned to Barrett.
Go get me a proper Coke.
What are you going to do with Lonnie?
I don't know. Put him on the case, I guess.